right now on Last Call. Energy stocks on fire, but there's something about the rally that could mean trouble. Speaking of energy, moments ago, one big area for U.S. production may be getting kneecapped by the White House. Adam Neumann on the record. Rare comments from the WeWork founder setting the investing world abuzz. The juice is gone, but the complicated legacy of O.J. Simpson and his blockbuster trial still reverberating today. Jane Wells covered it live and is here. Plus, the ultra wealthy getting ultra worried at least about one thing. We have got a new report you're going to want to see. And the NFL legend who wants to go deep on casinos, Bruce Smith, is here. Live, all that and more over the hour. So as always, belly up or buckle up. Last Call is up right now. Hi, everybody. Good evening here. Good afternoon to all of you out west. I mean, all of you. I'm Brian Sullivan. All that and more coming up in our hour. But first up on Last Call, what else but your money? Here's the good news. Stocks bouncing back a bit after yesterday's inflation-fueled sell-off. The Dow, yeah, down a little bit, but who cares about the Dow? It's all about technology. And the NASDAQ closing at a new record high. Now, that's largely thanks to a group of stocks you might have heard out before. Some people call them the Magnificent Seven. And they got their mojo back today. Apple and NVIDIA posting a nice 4% pop. That was best day for Apple this year. Alphabet and Amazon also hitting all-time highs. In the meantime, Meta, Facebook's parent, within striking distance of its record close. Of course, two magic letters have powered these names for the better part of a year. That is A and that is I, artificial intelligence. And according to Amazon CEO Andy Jassy, the new technology is going to fuel more, maybe many more, gains ahead.
AI is going to transform every customer experience that we know. We think there are three big macro areas of the generative AI stack, each of which are gigantic and each of which we're investing deeply in.
You hear that sound? That is the sound of your customer service department turning into robots. Anyways, earnings kick off tomorrow with the banks. Is the Magnificent Seven where you want to be? Let's talk about it with our leadoff market panel, and it's a big one tonight. Joining us, Charles Schwab, Senior Investment Strategist, Kevin Gordon here on set, and Carson Group Chief Market Strategist, Ryan Dietrich as well. Ryan, good to see you. Kevin, thanks for coming in. Another trash weather night here in New Jersey. Is Schwab just saying put all your money, take all of grandma's money and put it in the Magnificent Seven and forget about it? I don't think so.
You know, as a narrative, it's interesting. That really started to fade even last year. You know, you look at the dispersion and some of the names. I mean, Apple finished 63rd place in 2023, so there were 62 other names in the S&P
that did better. I'm joking.
And then, you know, well, you look this year, too, and even though, you know, you put up that performance of the Mag 7 this year, you know, Apple and Tesla have been really lagging down, you know, double-digit percentage points year-to-date. And it's the NVIDIAs of the world that have been really leading. So as a group, there's been a lot of fraying there, and there hasn't been a lot of staying power, you know, to the Mag 7 as an index, even though it's making an all-time high.
Well, let's be clear. When you say the NVIDIAs of the world, that's like saying the Brad Pitts of the world. I mean, there's one of them, right? It's NVIDIA,
yeah.
And it's Brad Pitt, and there's not another one. I don't think there's a second one.
That's true.
Right?
Yeah. But I will, you know, the AI, if this also folds in another narrative, in addition to the Mag 7 one, you know, we've sort of been, I think, you know, there's a glut of narratives that have been introduced in the market
Yes.
in the past couple of years. Specifically this year, when you look at something like the AI one, it's really tough for me, at least, when you look at the performance and the breakdown in performance, where all of the gains have been, and the strongest gains have been, even if you go back to last year when the craze really started to get going, you know, the sectors that have been doing really well, the names that have done the best, spans industrials, consumer discretionary, tech. So to me, it's not necessarily just a tech story tied to the AI narrative. Mm. It's kind of a love being shared between both the creators and the adopters. So I think it's a much bigger kind of blanket being thrown over, you know, the AI narrative itself in terms of what performance, where you've been able to find the consistency and outperformance.
Ryan, one could suggest the media sometimes will engage in hyperbole from time to time, but we won't go into that.
Never.
Ryan, what is your main narrative/theme in the market right now?
Yeah, Sully, thanks for having me back. I mean, it's amazing to us. Yesterday was down about 1% on the S&P, and then we bounced back. I just looked at that. Like, this year, Brian, is one of the best years we've ever had. We have a modest loss the day before. Now, by that, I looked at 0.75%, so pretty decent loss. The day after that, this year, stocks have, like, gained all that back. This is, like, the best year we've ever seen. Now, I get it. This year is a long way to go, but I think it kind of tells you there's a little bit of a hiccup. Yesterday, we're all worried about CPI. Then PPI comes out today, and some of the worries we had yesterday, you look at auto insurance and medical services. Oh, maybe it's not the worry that it was. So I think that's something that's really kind of caught our attention. The other thing, listeners need to remember this. One final point here. We're up 30% the last 12 months, right? We're up 5 months in a row on the S&P. We've been bullish. You know, we still think the stocks are going to go higher. But let's just be clear that maybe a well-deserved consolidation, heaven forbid, a 5% pullback would be perfectly normal here, Brian. And honestly, probably warranted. We've only had a 2% peak-to-trough correction all year, right? The record was 95, 2.5%. So, hey, it's a great scenario for investors, but we think let's just put in perspective here.
I think it's normal to see a pullback.
You were nodding along.
Yeah, I mean, I think, but, you know, you look at the max drawdown at the, not only for the S&P, but for the NASDAQ, for the Russell, you know, for all intents and purposes, has not been bad. The one thing I will say is that there's been a lot of churn under the surface of this market year to date. So if you look at the, you know, member level, the average member's maximum drawdown for the S&P is at correction territory, down 10%. The average for the Russell is down 22%, which is bear market territory. So there's already been a lot of consolidation and a lot of churn. It just hasn't bubbled up to the overall index level. I think that's a great way to go through a correction or, in the case of some small caps, a bear market. But, you know, at some point, with sentiment still running hot, all of the metrics we look at, both on the attitudinal and the behavioral side, you're still in this, call it extreme optimism zone, where, you know, you typically get to that at some point in a bull market. Doesn't mean it's fatal and that, you know, the bull market has to come to an end. But once you get some of that froth worked out and you go through some sort of corrective phase, it tends to, you know, sort of set you right back on the
track. You know, Ryan, I was always told growing up, don't say the word hate. It's too strong of a word. Say I dislike. There's only four things in the world I dislike. The Baltimore Orioles, beets, olives, and talking about the Fed every freaking day. Are we that tied? And the Orioles thing, that's a whole personal issue when I was a child. Are we that really this tied to the Federal Reserve in terms of which Fed goes, oh, things change. Small caps fall 2%. Oh, they go the other way. Small caps rise 2%.
Yeah, it sure feels like we are. But then we take a step back, right? In the first quarter, S&P 500 forward earnings estimates for the year were up 3%. What in the world does that mean? Well, 2019, they're up only 2% for the full year. Okay, so that's a really good. That's really good. We got earnings season come up again. We're optimistic. We're going to see strong things out of corporate America and honestly from the consumer. So does that have much to do with the Fed? We would say probably not. Now, I'm not naive. We understand that, you know, the Fed does move things when they talk and you have things. But let's just remember, the last thing we heard from Powell was he hinted at three cuts. I get it. He probably might have changed his mind since then, but we're still optimistic we see one or two. But at the bottom line, Brian, in 22, when the Fed was hawkish, why? Of course, because supply chain issues, massive inflation. Why are a little more hawkish now than they were 6-8 weeks ago? Because again, the economy is strong and earnings have continued to justify this bull market. So, I think it's a nice place to be, just not to always rely on the Fed. These fundamentals are still good.
Best piece of advice Schwab and Kevin Gordon are giving their clients right now is?
Well, as it relates to the Fed, I mean, you can't use just the Fed and the direction of monetary policy to sort of base your investment decision, at least for the equity market. Because
if you go
back to all 14, you know, full Fed cycles, so you had, you know, the pause, I guess, leading into the hikes, then the pause, and then the cuts. In seven of those instances, when you go from the final hike and you go out and look in 6-12 months after, seven of those instances, the market went up. Seven of those instances, the market went down. So that doesn't really tell me anything. It's basically just a coin flip. If anything, you have to look at what the actual economic data is, the environment that we're in and that's surrounding us, and that sort of gives you more of a tell as to whether the stock market's going to do well. So if the Fed's embarking on a slower cutting cycle this year, tends to actually be well for, you know, be good for stocks.
I said it earlier on CNBC, I don't know what Jay Powell can do about the price of auto insurance, but I guess we'll find out. Kevin Gordon, Ryan Dietrich, great conversation, gentlemen. Thank you very quickly. You got the guy that runs BlackRock on CNBC tomorrow morning. Check that out. All right. Let's take a look at what happened inside the markets today. Your stud of the day, Paramount Global, David Faber. Breaking news this morning that Skydance Media will begin doing due diligence on a potential deal with at least parts of Paramount next week. The big decliner, Globe Life. That's not a misprint. Lost 53%, more than half its value. It's a huge story. Herb Greenberg is on it coming up. Up next, call it a Fairbanks freeze out. A U.S. oil production could soon be put on ice by President Biden. Plus, he's back. WeWork founder Adam Neumann has a new billion-dollar startup and an exclusive and rare interview with the WeWork founder and Deirdre Bosa raising some eyebrows. You'll hear it coming up. And let's get to tomorrow's news tonight. First up, a big story around Morgan Stanley. A federal probe into the bank's wealth management arm sending shares way down. The Wall Street Journal reports that the SEC, the Comptroller of the Currency, and the Treasury Department are involved. The investigation involves whether or not Morgan Stanley looks hard enough into the backgrounds of its prospective clients, like where their wealth comes from and their financial activity. That may seem weird, but they're not prying. It's kind of industry practice to ensure there aren't things like criminal activity or money laundering going on. Shares of Morgan Stanley falling just over 5% on that news. Also happening now, Bloomberg reporting that President Biden will move to block Arctic oil drilling across roughly half of Alaska's North Slope. The White House plan would not impact the already approved ConocoPhillips Willow project, but it would be far more expansive than originally thought. Let's bring in Neil Chatterjee to break this down. He is the former chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Neil, good to see you again. Listen, by the way, there's also another story today about a giant oil export terminal off the coast of Texas being approved. So that's being approved. That has environmentalists up in arms. So my guess is this Arctic ban is probably just a PR strategy to block out the other headlines of the oil terminal being approved. What do you think?
Yeah, of course. Look, it's April of 2024. We're in a presidential election year, and the administration is trying to balance economic growth with placating their base. And they have been struggling with energy politics ever since the Willow decision. They initially approved Willow. They were not ready for the backlash that occurred. So ever since, they've been throwing everything they can against the wall, whether it's the LNG pause or this potential much broader blocking of Arctic oil drilling. But at the same time, they might approve Calcasieu Pass too. They might, they're approving this export facility. They just can't figure out where to land between economic growth and pleasing their environmental space.
Because $5 gasoline across most of America, I'm not looking at you, California or Hawaii, $5 or Alaska for that matter, $5 gas is terrible for election prospects. So you want energy costs to be low, but when you've got millions of people who voted for you because you said you were going to, quote, phase out fossil fuels, and now we're at record oil production, record LNG production, record LNG exports. I mean, I didn't have that on my bingo card for the last 3 years, Neil.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, the Biden energy record
is like unbelievable.
Their rhetoric, and whether they intended or not, we're at record levels of production, which is why I think they're now trying to play these kinds of games. Look, Alaska's a red state. They're not going to get those electoral votes. So they figure, why not take a shot at Alaskan production? We can send a signal to our base and not hurt our electoral prospects. Here's the problem. These projects, whether the LNG pause, which they, I think, mistakenly think only hits the Gulf, or this decision, which would only hit Alaska, there's ancillary jobs throughout the economy. There are people, pipe fitters in Wisconsin and Michigan, yep, and Ohio, people who make component parts that work in all these facilities who are also impacted. This is a very short-sighted decision, in my view.
Neil, thank you so much. Another story that we've been following, the launch of WeWork founder Adam Neumann's new venture. It's called Flow. Now, Flow says they're aiming to transform the residential experience, and they've got the backing of giant VC firm Andreessen Horowitz. Deirdre Bosa exclusively interviewed Neumann today and joins us now with some of the highlights. Deirdre, it's starting to feel a little bit deja vu with Mr. Neumann, who has a very uncanny ability to raise money. What is he doing different this time?
It's a good question, Brian. And I was here. I'm in Fort Lauderdale, one of two buildings that launched under that Flow title today. And like he did with WeWork, Adam Neumann is trying to brand Flow as a technology innovator and disruptor. So I asked him what made it a technology company, since there's a number of other large real estate companies doing very similar things, purpose-built rentals. Here's what he had to say.
There's a lot of different things you can do in a building. Yeah. Technology represents the backbone and the front end of running all those things.
Right, and you were showing me the app, which launched today as well, but I'm still wondering, how is it disruptive? Because when I look at this purpose-built rental category, it's around. You've got people like One Hudson Yards or an Avalon Bay or even a Toll Brothers is doing something similar. So what is the actual technology in your building that separates it from one of them?
So this is an interesting question. You could build a tech company that's only the backbone of real estate. Okay. And you can build a branded operating company that's only the operation of the business. The only way you can build something integrated is if you're doing both at the same time. There's not one, as far as I know, all the names you just said do not build their own technology. They actually rely on third parties.
And Brian, that's not exactly true, because related companies, one of the companies I mentioned to him, which owns and operates Hudson Yards, actually did develop their residential app in-house. So it leaves us with the question still, can Adam Neumann sell another real estate company as a tech company? I don't think that he was able to do that on our air today, but you mentioned this at the top. He's been able to convince some very prestigious other investors that he is. Andreessen Horowitz put $350 million into Flow at a $1 billion valuation. And this is one of the most well-known venture capital firms in Silicon Valley. Part of the reason of that, Brian, is the cult of the founder. The idea that people like Neumann and other tech entrepreneurs may fail before they succeed, but at least they're, quote, in the arena.
You and I talked about this yesterday when you were here in the office. I mean, how compelling. I would love to meet Adam Neumann. He's like 6'6", weighs like 100 pounds less than I do. You know, there's some sort of, there must be some kind of aura around this guy that enables him to sell ideas to some of, ostensibly, the smartest people in the world. Did you gather? Did you see something happening around him?
I mean, look at what happened with WeWork. At its peak, it was worth $47 billion. Now in the U.S., it's in bankruptcy proceedings. He was able to convince Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan, Masasan of SoftBank, and now add Andreessen Horowitz to that list after the WeWork implosion. So, yes, there is something about him. He's able to sort of have a really convincing message, but I don't know what to tell you, Brian. I asked him a number of times what the tech proposition is, and it wasn't there. So I don't know if it's because I'm a journalist. We don't see it necessarily as much as maybe some of the investors, because we don't have this cult of the founder, perhaps, as well. We talk to a lot of different CEOs across a lot of different industries, and venture capital is a very specific place where the wins can be huge. You only need to win one out of 100 or 1,000.
We need to cue the 90s rock anthem by Living Color, Cult of Personality. I think that's perfect, what you just said there. Deirdre Bosa.
I mean, can I just bring it to the modern day as well? I mean, you have someone like Sam Altman, right, who is seen as one of the smartest people in generative AI, and he was kicked out of his own company just to be brought back 5 days later. He's also a controversial figure in the Valley, and the line between success and failure for these entrepreneurs can sometimes be very, very thin.
Yep. Well said. I like it. Deirdre Bosa, thank you very much. Fascinating stuff. All right, coming up, how a rather mysterious short seller just tanked shares of an insurance company. Who else but Herb Greenberg on the case? All right, welcome back. It was a brutal day for investors in one little talked about member of the S&P 500, although that's probably about to change. Shares of a company called Globe Life got rocked. They're a life insurer, and investors lost half their money today. In fact, investors lost 4 years of gains just today. So you're probably asking, who or what could have done this? Well, the answer is Fuzzy Panda. That's right. Fuzzy Panda Research. This is an anonymous short seller. They issued a new report against Globe Life. Now, whoever this short seller actually is, we doubt it's a panda. They struggle to use computers given that they're Their paws are too large. But this person alleged that Globe Life has been engaged in a fraud as well as millions of dollars of potentially illegal kickbacks. Of course, these are powerful and these are dangerous accusations. And Globe Life came out with a statement of its own, saying in part, quote, "We reviewed the report and found it to be wildly misleading, mixing anonymous allegations with recycled points pushed by plaintiff law firms to coerce Globe Life into settlements. The motivations behind this short seller's report are driven solely by short-term profit earned on the backs of thousands of shareholders." Wow. With us tonight for more on this so-called fuzzy panda as a man who's... It wasn't my stomach. That's a sound effect, although I am... Herb could be known to be pretty fuzzy from time to time himself. I don't know who... we got Muddy Waters. Now we got Fuzzy Panda. What do you... I'm sure you must know this guy or woman.
No, I actually... No, I actually don't. I actually went back and forth with him on text a few years ago when
you
I had
said
my Scaramucci moment. No. I don't know him. I can't tell you who he or she is because I don't know the person's identity. I almost met this person because we went back and forth when I did my Scaramucci moment of attempting activist short selling.
How about this? Okay, well, at least you have this fuzzy. Apparently, Fuzzy Panda has a phone. Is it legit? Yeah. Are they legit? Are they a legit research outfit? Because they just moved a big stock, 53%.
Well, among the activist short sellers, what I can say is based on what they have published in the past over a number of years, they've had some really good calls. And that's really the issue here. You know, look, I'd love to see people back when Carson Block was Muddy Waters and we didn't know who Carson Block really was. He didn't use his real name. Always love to see people use their real names. You know, Hindenburg is Nate Anderson. We get it. But in the end, the question is the information correct? That is what this is going to hang on. But it's not just the report, Brian, because what Fuzzy Panda did that was so either brilliant or whichever way you want to look at it is sort of took a page out of what Hindenburg did when they did their big call that put them on the map with Nikola, the truck company, when they did a video of a truck rolling
and
down.
They were right. These guys, they got it right.
These people put out a 6-minute video. Now that video, that's a heck of a video. And it's not just the report, which if the allegations are correct, is, you know, there's some really egregious things going on here if it's correct. But this video, oh my goodness, it's as intriguing as anything I've seen.
I want to turn off the show and go watch it. Forget last call. Let's go to YouTube.
It's out there. Yes, it's on / Twitter.
And are you saying the video is better than just a report? Because for the average investor, they can, let's just be honest, it's easier to watch a video than to read something hard. I mean, I'm sorry to say that.
I think the video is enough to whet your appetite to make you want to read the report and to take a look at what the company said in the rebuttal. And the rebuttal is like all rebuttals to these things. And we've seen this from, you know, all of these companies. Sometimes the companies are
so weird,
you know.
We got to go. And they said it's, you know, wildly misleading. But companies have got to stop have got
to
stop putting into these short seller, you know, it's driven by short term profit. Of course it is. Everything
of
is.
Of course.
Like it's like that's
at
the,
least they're...
stop putting those things in statements.
That's the point. You at least know their position. They're telling you they're talking their book. They're telling you they're potentially making a profit here if you read the fine print of their disclosures. So, look, this is an interesting one. And let's not forget, Berkshire Hathaway had sold the stock, all of its stock, at the beginning of the year in this company. And then Nate Kopiker of Orso Capital came out with something at the Sohn conference on this company. And Nate Kopiker, you may not know of, but, man, I wouldn't want to mess with him. So,
okay. Or a panda with two Glocks, okay? Yeah, I want to put it back. If you're on the radio, okay, Fuzzy Panda's logo, that's our sound effect, is what looks to be a picture of a panda drawn by the artist Banksy, and the panda is flashing two pistols. I go look it up whenever you get to where you're arriving. Herb Greenberg, a heck of a story. Really appreciate it, my man. Thank you.
Sure, take care.
All right, meantime... Move over, tech. Our old pal energy is topping the market this quarter, but here's the not so good news. Apparently, strength in energy could be bad for the macro market. Joining us now tonight from Bespoke Investment Group is co-founder Paul Hickey to explain. Do you have like a cute, you need like a cute logo. Exactly, like an octopus
that
with eight knives.
That looked like he was wearing a diaper too.
I think it was wearing a diaper. I didn't want to say anything about it. But listen, it's an adult, could be an adult diaper.
You know,
people have, we go into China, the world and go out of the too, world right? wearing a diaper in a lot of places. It's fine. Why is energy good, bad for the market?
So when energy is leading, like you saw in the first few days of this quarter, it's when the other sectors are down, it's not a good situation for the market. What we call it is the three-headed monster of the market. You have energy rising, the dollar rising, and interest rates rising. Those factors in unison when they're all hitting highs is a negative signal. We're not at that point at this point, but it's something to be watching for. And think about it. When energy is the only sector, when energy is rallying like it has been, there's a reason for it usually. Right now we're on concerns of tensions in the Middle East. But
it's also, I will say this, and you're exactly right. We've talked about it a lot. Energy is my thing, as you might know. But I think energy too, oil is like a bond proxy also. I think the interest rate complex is moving oil. People that may not be involved in oil are moving it as like a proxy for interest rates. Well, and I honestly, Paul, I don't know who's leading who.
Well, nowadays, do you ever know who's leading who in the market? Some of these
panda.
But, you know, the energy.
Prickly whole, koala research.
As a whole, the energy sector is a great hedge at this point. It's trading at 12 times earnings, 3% dividend yield. It's got the best breadth of any sector in the market right now. But if you are seeing the manufacturing sector start to turn around, the energy sector is a good place to be. You just don't want it to be the leading sector, but it can rise with the overall market, but it can't be the leader, and because it's usually a sign of bad things.
Well, it is the leader. I think it's the best performing group.
So far this quarter, but the quarter's only about less than 2 weeks old.
What about this year? It's got to be close to the top. If it's not number one, it's got to be number two.
On the year, no, tech and communication services are still significant.
Well, when you say I love what I hate about these S&P groups, communication services, it's basically Meta.
Right.
Meta. And a bunch of names. Maybe
Google.
Verizon.
Google's in there, too.
What's that? Yeah.
Google's
so it's Meta and Google.
Yeah,
they're primarily because of cable companies.
AT&T and Verizon aren't around.
Well, cable companies haven't been doing a whole lot. So that's fascinating. Is there a period of time which it has to go that far before it's like really bad news?
You know, I think what the key to watch is every bull market has a theme. This bull market's theme is AI. And even in the AI-related stocks in the S&P 500 have outperformed since the bull market started year to date. But even during this pullback in the market that we've seen, the AI-related stocks are actually, NVIDIA's down 10%, but the other AI-related stocks are down about 1.5% this quarter. The rest of the average stock, the other 467, are down about 3%. So they're holding up. If you start to see those AI stocks start to underperform a little bit while energy's holding up, that would be a caution sign.
The best performer in the mid-caps, Vistra, which makes power for data centers to make energy infrastructure. Paul Hickey, thank you very much.
Panda time.
Diaper panda. All right. Coming up, remember this.
Less than an hour after being sent back into deliberations from hearing that testimony, they buzzed three times and told Judge Ito they have a verdict.
Yeah, that's CNBC legend Jane Wells all over the O.J. Simpson murder trial, and now the juice is gone, but a complicated legacy that transformed an industry is far from over. Jane Wells will be live with us next. Well, the juice is gone. O.J. Simpson, one of the most infamous people in America, if not the world, died at 76 today after battling prostate cancer. Putting it mildly, Simpson behind leaves a complicated legacy. But to this very day, his criminal trial over the alleged murder of his ex-wife and her friend, Ron Goldman, is one of the biggest stories in modern American history. It literally gripped the entire nation. And Simpson and Al Cowling's low-speed police chase through the Los Angeles neighborhoods in a white Bronco, still one of television's most watched events of any kind ever. In fact, did you know, because I didn't until today, 95 million Americans watched it happen live. Now, in 1995, O.J. was acquitted of the murders, what was called the trial of the century. It lasted 9 months, captivated the nation for all that time, and more than 150 million Americans watched the verdict. That eclipses any Super Bowl, the finale of MASH, the finale of Seinfeld, anything. The country effectively stood still when the verdict was being read. In fact, AT&T saw phone call volume drop off a cliff, even trading volume. The New York Stock Exchange dropped 41%. No one did anything but watch TV, and the trial turbocharged the rise of the 24-hour cable news industry, whatever you may think about it. Now, one of the young, upstart, but clearly heavily talented reporters covering the saga was a woman named Jane Wells.
The jury in the O.J. Simpson case has reached a verdict. We will hear the unanimous verdicts apparently reached in less than one day of deliberations by this jury.
With us now is the aforementioned Jane Wells. Jane, what a day, what a time. Tell us, just talk to us. Do what you do the best.
Well, you know, we're coming up on the 30th anniversary of the murders this June, and it's been 30 years. And a lot of today I was thinking, Brian, how would that trial of the century be covered today? Would it still be the trial of the century? And I would argue, yes, it would, because there was just nothing like it in a defendant like O.J. Simpson, who was just beloved, and this horrific butchering of two people. And you have to understand, in Los Angeles, we were just a year out from the riots after the LAPD officers were acquitted in the beating of Rodney King. So Los Angeles and much of the country were just as much racially on edge then as I think in many cases they have been now, especially after George Floyd. And it captivated, as you said, it really was a launch pad for cable news. It put Court TV on the map. It was an interesting balance because at the local station where I covered much of the criminal trial before moving over to WNBC and then CNBC, you couldn't run commercial breaks unless the judge called a recess. So you weren't making money, but you were, and you were paying a ton of it to your crews, but you were building this audience that then found that it needed to turn to cable news the way CNN grew an audience during the first Gulf War. Would it be different today with social media? Of course it would. You wouldn't have to find a radio or a TV or have someone page you the verdict on a pager, if you could remember that. There's a story of a U.S. Navy aircraft carrier where they had to put up a phone to a TV back in Washington so they could hear the verdict. It would be different now because you would get the news instantaneously.
Yeah, I mean, and the magnitude of this, a lot of our team members here, Last Call team, some of them weren't born yet. Some of them were way too young to remember. Trying to explain to them, take a Taylor Swift concert, take the Super Bowl, take the finale of Friends, and this was bigger than those things combined.
Oh, there was, you know, there really was nothing like it. Maybe the Lindbergh baby back, you know, earlier, but there was no live TV going on then, and there wasn't the racial element. And the funny thing about covering it in L.A., being a native here, everybody in Los Angeles, there was like 6 degrees of separation with that trial. We all knew somebody involved in the trial. In my case, my husband flew in the Navy Reserve with the American Airlines pilot who flew O.J. to Chicago the night of the murders, went back and shook his hand in first class, had him autograph his flight logbook. And then later testified as a defense witness because that pilot didn't recall OJ's hand being cut. And that was a big point of contention. When did OJ cut his hand? Did he cut it during the murders? But that's just one example. Everybody knew somebody tied to the case.
And it changed TV?
It changed. You know, there had been a few live trial coverage before then, but this proved that you could build an audience by televising trials live. And it cost a lot of money in overtime, but it didn't require a lot of work. Yeah. And I just think we've seen a lot of that grown. You know, I worked for Rivera Live for the second trial, which was the wrongful death suit. That put his show on the map. That was an evening, a primetime cable TV show. And I think the night of the verdict, they got like over 5 million viewers, which was the highest rating CNBC had ever gotten to that point.
Wow.
And so you started to see these evening personality shows come into focus, wrapped around this case and then launched from there. O'Reilly, yep. Another example.
Just truly, truly amazing. And you live through it. Crazy times. Glad to see you doing so well. Jane Wells, we'll see you again soon, I hope. Jane, thank you.
Yes,
all right,
you
coming
will.
Up. Why the ultra rich are feeling ultra worried, at least about one thing, plus the great Bruce Smith on his big casino plans. All right, welcome back. A brand new survey says the super rich, I mean the really rich, are turning to more conservative investment vehicles, not politics. We're talking about like real estate instead of stocks. Let's talk about what the ultra rich are doing with Barbara Goodstein. She is the managing partner of R360, the firm that conducted the study. They are an investment group for the centimillionaires. That's a group that has more than $100 million as a family. They got families with $40 billion in total assets. It's a group I will never, maybe I'll go to a meeting. I'll never be in the group. But Barbara, it's great to see you. Thanks for joining us. What are the super duper rich doing right now?
So we're doing a number of things. We're actually very positive on Bitcoin. We had a conversation last night and somebody said, don't constrain your imagination, which I thought was a perfect way to describe Bitcoin. Anything can happen and the best is yet to come. So we have one of our members is one of the top hedge fund managers, and he's been telling people for many months now, invest in Bitcoin. Multiple things were going to happen.
You've been right, too.
That's right.
Made your members a lot of money.
We had the ETF situation. We had mark-to-market, and now we're expecting halving.
Okay.
So Bitcoin is one of the first things that we're telling people that we're high on. And then another thing.
But are you high on it like, let's buy a little Bitcoin and have some fun, not sell the house, sell the car, sell the kids, buy Bitcoin?
No, I don't think it will ever be sell the house and the car. I think that Bitcoin is a corollary almost to gold. So it's an asset class that you want to hold. It's an inflation hedge, and it's had spectacular performance over the past 14 years. It's been the number one asset class. So there's a lot of good positives related to Bitcoin, but it's also incredibly volatile.
Yeah, it is, and it can be risky. It's gone down 80%, like I think 10 times over its lifespan. Now, some of that was from like a nickel to 2 cents. So, but you get my point. What else are the super rich, the R360 members doing?
So when we invest in public equities, we're very judicious about where members invest and they're looking for dividends. So people probably don't realize when Warren Buffett invests, 55% of his returns come from dividends. And we're looking at the same thing.
You know, I go out and speak at a group called Tiger 21. Used to be the CEO, I think, of Tiger 21. Sort of a competing organization in terms of net worth. And bring that pie chart back up, Taylor, if we can, because it's only 16% public equities. Tiger, I think, was about only 19%. Why do the super rich dislike stocks so much?
So I don't think it's that they dislike stocks because, as I said, we're finding the opportunities within the public equity markets, but there are also opportunities in private markets, like private capital markets, private credit markets is an enormous opportunity, and that's where we're pivoting to. But within public equities, we've found dividend stocks that really yield, and then we've also found other opportunities that are paying off for everybody.
And the Bitcoin, we love it. Come back anytime, Barbara Goodstein. Let us know what the super duper rich, not just super rich, the super duper rich
are
doing.
That's right.
Barbara, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, speaking of quantum, politicians and business leaders in Colorado are looking past AI to invest in what's called quantum computing. Think super duper computing power and tiny chips, lightning fast processing speed, and the potential to supercharge the economy. Well, Carl Quintanilla dives deeper into that and some of the other key industries powering the Boulder and Denver area, like aerospace, tech, sports, and even cannabis, Rocky Mountain High. It's all in a brand new CNBC special tonight at 10 p.m. called Cities of Success, Denver, Boulder. And here's a sneak preview.
When people think of semiconductors, they go to Silicon Valley. When people think of quantum, all around the world, quantum will not only be something that everybody engages with on a daily basis, but they think of Denver Boulder as the epicenter for that. It would be the Silicon Valley for quantum.
Zachary Yuroshomi leads Elevate Quantum. The public-private consortium represents over 100 leaders, labs, and organizations in the region that all want to secure the Mountain West's position at the center of quantum developments.
And the idea there is to create Silicon Valleys where there aren't Silicon Valleys today against the most important technologies of our time.
Helping assure one of those Silicon Valleys flourishes here, Yura Shalmi recently applied for and won Colorado the federal designation as a tech hub for quantum technology.
We competed against 400 applicants across the nation, and we're fortunate to be selected as one of 31.
It's all part of the Biden administration's CHIPS and Science Act, and it's the first step toward unlocking thousands of jobs and accessing millions in federal grants.
This is where things really get hot. We're competing for $70 million from the federal government.
Only 3 to 8 hubs will be selected to receive funding. Zachary's optimistic on their chances, saying he expects a decision later this year.
It's going to be foundational to our economy in the way that the internet is. It couldn't get bigger.
So you do kind of think of it as a gold rush.
Oh, yeah. It's going to make the gold rush look like the, you know, tin rush by comparison.
Again, Cities of Success tonight, 10 p.m. Eastern. You won't want to miss it. You won't want to miss what's coming up either. NFL legend Bruce Smith wants to get into the casino business in Virginia. He will join us on that next. All right, welcome back. An NFL legend wants to tackle the casino business. Hall of Famer Bruce Smith putting his name and his money behind a potential casino project in Petersburg, Virginia. That is just south of Richmond. Now, Smith's real estate development company is partnering with real estate firm The Cordish Company in the effort and taking on some big players in the process. A proposed live Virginia casino, if approved, expected to generate over $2.8 billion in revenue for the Petersburg area for its first 10 years, as well as 7,500 jobs. Smith expected to detail his plans at a town hall in Petersburg this weekend. Joining us now is Buffalo Bills Hall of Famer Bruce Smith. Bruce, good to have you back on. Listen, Petersburg, if you know it, it's had a rough road economically. What kind of an economic impact would this project have on Petersburg?
Well, first of all, I am so excited for the city and the citizens of Petersburg for us to have this opportunity to create change. This city has been historically disenfranchised and ignored, and we have an opportunity to right this ship. You just read off the numbers, the jobs, the economic stimulus that will take place. But more importantly, this isn't about brick and mortar. This is about changing people's lives and giving them a brighter future and looking forward to prosperity. I will be the co-developer of this enormous project and this undertaking, and I am so excited to be in contention with four of the developers and vying for this particular opportunity.
Yeah, people don't realize you've got a very successful real estate development company as well. Is the project in Petersburg going to go forward no matter who wins, Bruce? I mean, is it you, or is there a chance this doesn't happen with anybody?
Well, first of all, it has to. The governor has done his job. The governor has signed the bill and sent it back to the state legislatures. Now it's in the hands of the Speaker, Don Scott. If he puts the reenactment clause back in, then it puts it in limbo. But if he does the right thing and he keeps the reenactment clause out of it, then it gets put on the ballot for a referendum in November, and then the people get an opportunity to decide their future, whether or not they want this enormous economic engine to come to their town and create all these massive numbers of jobs, economic stimulus, the tax revenue, and provide new hope. And obviously, talking about what this will do for families in disenfranchised communities, this will be what they've been waiting for a lifetime.
Yeah, a lot of people be critical of casinos, but from a jobs perspective, Bruce, there's no doubt there's the construction, there's this, there's that. And here's the reality. And I think a lot of people will say, well, casinos can do a lot of harm. Look at Atlantic City, et cetera, et cetera. Here's what they don't get. If Petersburg doesn't do it, and I hate to use it, somebody else is going to do it, right? I mean, it's going to go up somewhere else. And Petersburg has, to your point, if you know it, and I do a little bit, not a lot, because it's economically been depressed for decades.
This is an opportunity for a lifetime. I just can't emphasize that enough. Petersburg needs this project, and it will be up to our elected officials to do the right thing to make sure that these folks in Petersburg has an opportunity at prosperity. This will affect a lot of problems that exist within the city of Petersburg. So, no pun intended, let's tackle these issues.
It's well said. Bruce Smith, we got to leave it there, my man. Thank you very much. Good luck. Keep us informed. Folks, I'm off tomorrow. See you Monday. Take care.